The good news comes to us today from the Gospel of Mark. Per long-standing tradition on this first Sunday of Advent, we read not from the beginning of the Gospel, but from the end. It is a bracing text, so I invite you to listen attentively for God's living word to you this day in these words and in what follows. But in those days, after that suffering, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Be aware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. The word of God for the people of God. Let's start with the obvious and admit that 2,000 years is a long time to keep awake. Let's also agree to another rather obvious point. It's deeply strange to begin the Advent season by reading a text like this one. With Christmas now on the near horizon, we are not announcing the arrival of Jesus on the world stage. Instead, we seem to be heralding the apocalypse, the end of the world. This particular passage in Mark is often called the mini-apocalypse, I guess because in just a few short verses, Mark describes the moment when the heavens and the earth shall pass away, something it takes the book of Revelation, the granddaddy of apocalyptic literature, 21 chapters to do. I'm sure there is some sacrosanct rationale for this long-standing tradition of starting Advent with the end of the world. But whatever it may be, I'm not going to bore you with trying to explain what it is, not just because I don't know what it is, but because I think I would like to start with a point I think is much more interesting. There's something fishy about this text. David Jacobson of the Boston University School of Theology explains it this way. Toward the end of a 16-chapter narrative about Jesus, that is, toward the end of the Gospel of Mark, early first century Jesus suddenly begins addressing his late first century hearers in the third person and often in the imperative mood. This is why many commentators on Mark see this particular part of the Gospel as most closely corresponding to the situation for which the gospel was written. Let me put that in simpler terms. New Testament scholars generally agree that Mark was the first gospel to be written down. It was compiled some 40 years after Jesus left the world stage. For the first 15 chapters of the book, the author of Mark, and we'll agree that it was Mark, there's debate about that, but we'll agree that it was Mark, he has Jesus speaking one way. He consistently refers to himself, that is, Jesus consistently refers to himself using the first person pronoun I, as most of us do. His stories and lessons are drawn from and focused on the events that are happening at the time he's preaching and teaching them. But here, the author suddenly switches things up. Jesus begins referring to himself as he. And most commentators agree that the inspiration for this story is the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem This is important because that devastating historical event occurred 4 decades after Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, as we've noted before from this pulpit, this kind of scholarly analysis often upsets people who take the Bible literally. It can unnerve readers who assume that the Bible was somehow dictated by God to a group of scribes who wrote it down verbatim and infallibly, word for word. But like it or not, that is not actually how the Bible was written, and I make this point again today because you can consider these kinds of scholarly insights suspiciously, or you can consider them respectfully and reverently. And when you make that shift, the Bible suddenly becomes more useful and more relevant to people like us, that is, to seekers and disciples dealing with the realities and complexities and challenges of the 21st century. For example, you learn that texts like this so-called mini-apocalypse, are less about the literal end of the world at some future time, and instead they're more of a theological commentary about the status of the world as it is right now. They are what scholars call crisis literature. They're meant to help readers navigate national or spiritual or moral emergencies. Like when the Temple of Jerusalem fell, that historical moment when the symbolic heart of Jewish identity and culture came crashing down around the Jewish people in a ruinous heap. 40 years after Jesus left them, Mark wants his followers to stay awake, to have hope, to trust and believe that they will get through this crisis because Jesus would not abandon his followers back then and he will not abandon them now. By his Spirit, his living Spirit, his living presence, he will continue to be Emmanuel, God with them and for them. Which is to say that this form of crisis literature, these apocalyptic stories, are for times like the one we're living in right now. Just a little over a year ago, I drove out to Highland Farms for our November Just for Fun event. By coincidence, it happened to fall the night after the national election last year. Most of us expected a different candidate to win that election. When that happened, had that candidate broken through America's last glass ceiling, I'm sure we would have commented on that, as that would have been a truly historic event. But this was not meant to be a political gathering, this Just for Fun event. It was a regularly scheduled time of fellowship around a shared meal that happened to coincide with the election. But then history threw us a bit of a curveball. So instead of delivering the short remarks I had planned to make, I spent part of the evening giving out hugs to people who were literally weeping. And perhaps a bit like the author of the book of Mark, it fell to me to offer words of hope to people whose bright view of the future had shifted overnight and had suddenly become dark and foreboding. Since then, the sun has not gone dark, exactly. The moon still gives its light, and the stars have not fallen from the heavens. But it's also true that the sun has frequently been obscured in this last year by a series of monstrous hurricanes. Tiki torches, rather than the moon and the stars, have lit up the night sky. And as story after story breaks about the pervasiveness in this country of sexual assault and sexual misconduct, Hollywood stars and political stars and TV stars, some of them dearly beloved, have begun to fall in such rapid and spectacular succession, it's like the Perseid meteor shower out there. Now, much more could be said about the threats we've faced this year and the disasters we've witnessed and the disasters we've resisted. not to mention the heartbreaking personal losses we've experienced as a church family in 2017. But I think it's enough to say that as happened to those late first century Jews, it feels to many of us like we're in the midst of our own mini apocalypse, a national moral and spiritual emergency, when the pillars of American identity and culture have come crashing down around us. Now, I'm aware that we've touched on these themes periodically over this last year, but plus, my brief as a preacher is to not preach bad news. My brief is to preach the good news. So here is some good news to anyone who wonders whether we're going to get through this crisis. This is not the first period in world history that has felt apocalyptic, and we are not the first people in the world to live through such a time. And to illustrate, I would like for you to join me in one of the imaginative exercises we do from time to time here. So if you're willing, I'd like for you to close your eyes and come with me as we travel to France. The year is 1916. Take a moment to shift yourself across the Atlantic and back a century. You're sitting in a trench somewhere along the upper reaches of the River Somme, except you're not actually French, you're English, so you're not entirely sure why you're here in the first place. What you do know for certain is that you're flanked by Allied troops in a line that stretches out to your right and to your left for several hundred yards. There are still other soldiers, hundreds of them in fact, hunkered down in similar trenches barely a stone's throw away. Some of these trenches are filled with troops who are on your side, but some of them lie on the other side of a tangled expanse of barbed wire, and these trenches are filled with many hundreds of men who are facing back at you, who are tasked with the job of shooting you and your fellows. You've been here now for 4 months. When you first arrived in July, the heat was stifling. But you endured it because you thought it would all be over soon. You thought you would capture the ground you and your mates had come here to take in a matter of days, a few weeks at most. But now it's November and you're freezing and you're hungry and you are exhausted. Yes, your side has made some incremental gains, but you can measure your progress in yards rather than in miles. Worse, you've surrendered some of this hard-won territory, retreating under the relentless pressure and pushback from the other side. So it's advance, retreat, like a deadly game of Sisyphean tag. And so there you sit in what feels like a literal hellscape. You have a pocket-sized copy of the New Testament in your coat, its pages dog-eared from daily use. Lately, you find yourself drawn to a story in the Gospel of Mark. It seems like it might have been written about the exact circumstances in which you find yourself, the world you have always known, the world you have always loved. This world has effectively ended. Even at noon, the sun is obscured by a black cloud of smoke from artillery blasts. When darkness finally falls, you realize you have not seen the light of the moon for weeks. You've forgotten what the stars look like. The only light is from the terrifying flash of bombs bursting all around you. If the story in Mark is true, you wonder if this might be the time Jesus is about to return. You certainly hope it is. But you also wonder how much longer you can stay awake waiting for him. You wonder if you even want to stay awake, whether you want to be alive in a world that has been reduced to a smoking ruin. But he does not return. And eventually the sun rises yet again. Then, just as you take out your pocket Bible for your morning prayers, the soldier next to you stands up. His head is above trench level. You worry that you might see him die. But you do not see him die. Something else happens instead, something that takes you totally by surprise, something wholly wonderful, something that involves not just your eyes, but your ears. He begins to sing. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. The words are new, but the tune is familiar. You've sung it every New Year's Eve for as long as you can remember. He finishes the refrain and begins again. On the next verse, you join in, and on the verse after that, other men join in. The simple chorus continues to repeat until all the trenches around you are filled with the sound of men hunkered down singing. You can't tell if it's a lament inspired by the absurdity of war in general or by the hopelessness of your specific situation, or whether it's a declaration of resolute hope rooted in the belief that these dark days, this ongoing nightmare, this mini-apocalypse will eventually pass and the smoke will clear and the sun will fill the sky by day and the moon and the stars will shine in the night once again. Or maybe it's both of those things. Both a song of mournful lament about the way the world is and a declaration of resolute hope that the way it will be, about the way it will be again someday. You can't really say for sure. The only thing you know for certain is that apart from the sweet cry your baby daughter made when she took her very first breath, this is the most beautiful sound you have ever heard in all your life. You might even be tempted to believe it's a chorus of angels singing, but for the barbed wire and the acrid tang of poisonous gas in the air, then you realize that's exactly what it is, a chorus of angels singing. And so you close your Bible and you give yourself heart and soul to the music, to the song. Now you can open your eyes. I owe the idea for that story to the writer John Green. He first heard a shorter version of it when he went to hear his friend and fellow author Amy Krauss Rosenthal do a reading from the new book she had just published. In relating this story, John noted that he himself suffers from bouts of clinical depression and acute anxiety. At the time he went to hear Amy, he was, as he himself put it, in a period of intense unwellness. He was losing himself to intrusive thought spirals and a chest-crushing depression. He managed to get to the event, but he was miserable, stuck in his own mini-apocalypse, trapped in such a dark mood, he felt he was not going to come out of it, at least not that night. Then Amy told this story about how a group of British soldiers began to sing this song, "We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here." Amy admitted that there was no obvious answer to why the soldiers were singing it. She allowed that it's possible to hear that song as a meaningless gesture, a hopeless lament. But then she went on to say that there was a whole other way to hear it. And when she explained what that was, John Green's darkness lifted. We're here because we're here. Meaning, we are here together, so that even when we feel alone, we aren't really. Because we are part of a vast and deeply interconnected us, as John Green put it, or in theological terms, as I might put it, we are part of the body of Christ. And we are here. We are alive right here. Right now, in this place. And so we sing this song as a declaration of resolute hope. And that declaration is fully warranted because hope is not foolish or idealistic or misguided. Hope, as John put it, hope is true. Hope is the correct response to the arc of history because we know that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. And when it feels like it's not bending or it's bending too slowly, we grab it with both hands and we pull with all our might. And that's when we remember that hope is not a feeling. Hope is something we wage. And yes, sometimes we have to wage it in the dark. Indeed, most often we have to wage it in the dark when the sun has gone dim and the moon will not give its light and the stars are falling from the heavens. But that's what makes it hope. John Green concluded his story by noting that some years are longer than others, and that for him, 2017 has been a very long one. Good and bad, and difficult and amazing, and joyful and terrifying, and very long, as he put it. I would have to agree. This year has been very long and very hard. And I'll confess that 2,000 years after Jesus left the world stage, it's tough to stay awake in 2017. But I would also add that we're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. One more time. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we are here.